Exam number three is going to be all about benzene aromaticity and conjugated systems. Now, we had already talked about kinetics versus thermodynamics this morning, and that, just to make sure, is just a lab topic. It will not even show up on the final. Yes. The what? Well, because we didn't have any of that on the exam yet, right? We had a quiz that touched on some of that.
But
so I'll ask again. On exam two, we had no question related to molecular orbital theory or conjugation or any of that, right? So all that material from then to now is the realm of material for exam three. So yes, if conjugation hadn't been on exam before, it potentially could be on one now. Right, but whatever we've covered in class is what's on the exam. If we haven't covered it, it's not exam material. I mean, that's the same policy we've had all along. So maybe you read something, some little detail we hadn't covered yet. We're not going to do it right now, right before the exam. So only whatever we have covered is on the exam.
Everything
since exam two. Or, because we started exam three material before we even took exam two, it's that chunk of material. So conjugation, benzene, and aromaticity. Those are the three topics. Now, we did have a quiz where you had, let's see, Frost Circle was in this section, was it? Or did you all have the...
Butadiene.
Yes, okay, I remember which one it was which now. So, you have not yet had any questions about Frost Circles. And, of course, there's this whole discussion we've been having about orthoparadirectors versus metadirectors and activators versus deactivators, which let me pause on that topic just for a moment, because in all three sections, there has been some confusion that's developed, because natural human tendency is want to categorize things and make things related to each other. And so when I say orthoparadirector, some people are having difficulty distinguishing between directing and activating. It does turn out that the same thing that causes something to be an activator is the same thing that causes it to be an orthoparadirector. But it's not true that being an orthoparadirector automatically makes something an activator. The halogens are the example of that. And what makes something a metadirector happens to be the same thing that makes it a deactivator. But just because something is deactivating doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a metadirector. So there's two distinct things going on. One is, where is increased electron density placed on a molecule due to delocalization? And so some of you individually have shown this too, but let me now show the whole section. That if we had something like one of the halogens, and I'll use fluorine as an example. Fluorine, we know it's electronegative, but ignore that for the moment. Just think of fluorine as something that has lone pairs and is able to do resonance. So even before reaction, we technically could write a resonance structure using fluorine, where we push electrons around a bit on the ring. You might think, well, that's going to be a terrible resonance structure. Of course it is. But part of the significance of it being a possible resonance structure is it does mean a bit more electron density could be at the ortho position. Or, if we to further push the charge around the ring, we could get it to the para position. So, I previously argued that something would be a good ortho-para director because it ends up placing a negative charge it places a positive charge in a position where it could be delocalized off the ring. But now this is a slightly different perspective. This is showing that even before the reaction begins, these resonance structures are showing that there's more electron density in the ortho position, ortho and para positions to begin with, which perfectly matches with the idea that that's where a positive charge would want to go. Because if before the reaction there's a buildup of negative charge, then after the reaction that same buildup will occur to help the positive charge that would form there. Now, and again, there's nothing we can do to move charge around to put it into the meta position. So totally separate from whatever its electronegative character is, totally separate from whatever inductive capacity fluorine might have, it is an orthopara director, purely because of resonance, no other reason. Now, Nock, you had a question. Oh, no, I'm sorry, that's my bad handwriting. No, everything we're doing this quarter, except... Now, did we do one reaction? We haven't done a radical reaction this quarter. We touched on, at the beginning of the quarter, the answers for last quarter where we had radical reactions. But everything is double-headed arrow this quarter. So... the ability of halogens or any other functional groups that have delocalizable lone pairs, their ability to be an orthopara director is purely because of resonance and nothing to do with the extent of electron donation or withdrawal that occurs. Or another way to say it is that halides and other functional groups that have delocalizable lone pairs cause electron density, cause greater electron density to exist at the ortho and para positions versus the meta position. This preferential uneven distribution of electron density is caused entirely by resonance. It has no connection to whether overall the functional group adds or removes electron density from the benzene ring. So that's what decides whether something's an orthopara director, is resonance. Or, remember that alkyl groups, through hyperconjugation, can also cause something to be an orthopara director. Then, what about whether it's activating or deactivating? That has only to do with whether overall electron density is added to or pulled from the ring. Has nothing to do with any of the resonance structures that occur. So to say it a slightly different way, if resonance was the only thing that made something an activator, then all things that have resonance would be activators, including the halogens. But it isn't what influences whether something's an activator or deactivator. It's whether overall electron density is added to or removed from the ring. Now for the halogens, we then discussed that there's this conflict in behavior, because halogens delocalize. That does add density. It adds more density to the ortho and para positions than it would to the meta. Halogens also then pull electron density right back again due to induction. Overall, they remove electron density. That causes a higher activation energy of a reaction because the rate-limiting step is forming the carbocation. But even though overall it's removing the electron density from the ring, there's still more of it at the ortho and para positions than the meta position. That's the distinction between ortho para versus meta directors, and then activators versus deactivators. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Why does it keep moving through the ring? It does. I just only chose to show two resonance structures because it shows me one ortho and one para. Move the charge one more time, and you get back to it being on the ortho position again. Move it one more time, you get back to the original compound.
So you actually...
It's all the way around. But, all the way around, but more concentrated at the ortho and para positions. Questions? All right. So, there would potentially be a question about what causes something to be ortho-para versus meta. There would potentially be a question on what makes something an activator versus a deactivator. Backing up a little bit from there, we have the question, is it aromatic, anti-aromatic, or non-aromatic? Which I think we've now hopefully cleared up what the difference between non-aromatic and anti-aromatic is. Okay, you had a question. Unlikely. Because if I gave you some random 20 carbon molecule, how do you know whether there's some unusual spatial thing that you don't know to look for because you don't know because you didn't ever see the molecule before? So my interest is not trying to trick you all. My interest is to see, do you know the underlying principles? Which we had several examples of systems that you could be questioned on. So four-membered ring, which wants to stretch because if it doesn't, it's anti-aromatic. Five-member ring, which loses a hydrogen easily, meaning it's acidic, because once it loses its proton, it becomes aromatic. Benzene, which is benzene. Then the tropium ion, which loses hydride, because once it does, it becomes aromatic. And then there's the cyclooctatetraene that is not planar, because if it were, it would be anti-aromatic. We also have pyrrole and pyridine, which show two different ways that lone pairs could be involved in a pi system, either to be parallel like the pyrrole case and be part of the pi system, or to be perpendicular and be more like pyridine. We have the 10-membered ring where the two hydrogens butt against each other, and that causes it not to be non-planar. So it'll only be those examples we've gone over in class. Or something really simple and obvious and non-trick question that I would give you to answer the question, is it aromatic, non-aromatic, anti-aromatic? Yes? You will not have paracyclic reactions, you will not have Diels-Alder's reactions. So it is limited to aromaticity, benzene, and conjugation. I'll say that again. There is no paracyclic reactions or Diels-Alder. Those will be on the final. That's aluminum is part of that. That's right. Mechanism. Oh, of course mechanism. So there is mechanism in demonstrating why something is ortho-para versus meta. There's mechanism to explain how can you do what looks like an SN2 on a halogen that's on benzene. In other words, the nucleophilic aromatic substitution. And, of course, we have our five reactions, nitration, sulfonation, acylation, alkylation, and halogenation, that you need to know the mechanisms for. And remember that each one of those only differs in how you make the electrophile. So if you can remember the first part, how do sulfuric acid and nitric acid react to make that NO2? What does happen to form the reactive intermediate in a Friedel-Crafts reaction? Yes, you still need to know those mechanisms. Are you shaking your head because you're realizing in theory I could write a 5-hour exam for just this one topic?
Yeah.
But I'm not going to be able to because we don't have that much time, so I'm going to have to do some creative selection of which questions to ask. Now, I know that you are probably thinking, why isn't he writing any of this down? Because I wouldn't do it for sections 1 and 2 this time, because they were trying even more aggressively to get specifically what was I going to ask. So I'll say all those things I said again to list them for you, but I'm not going to write them down. But I did just write what potentially could be the exam right here in front of you, because a perfect question is, why is something orthopara versus meta? Another standard question is, why is something activating versus deactivating? You're going to write a mechanism for one of those five reactions: sulfonation, nitration, acylation, alkylation, halogenation. You're going to have to do one of those at least. No, there is no synthesis, because we still haven't done any. I might have shown one example of why you might have to do a synthesis in a particular way to make a particular benzene derivative, but not part of the exam. So other than those things I just named, the things that we've been talking about most recently, then there's the Frost circle, there's conjugation, although you might have some logic to say, if you've already answered a question about butadiene and cyclobutadiene, do you think I'm going to ask another one? It's possible, but that might be a judgment call you want to make as far as where to devote your time. Yes? Of course, benzene, benzaldehyde, benzoic acid, aniline, phenol, toluene. Did we do cresol? Okay. Xylene, styrene, yes, all those, that list of molecules that we put up. And, theoretically, some simple systematic example, because we did do one systematic nomenclature of a benzene molecule. So there aren't going to be any surprises on this exam. Questions, then? Systematic would be using 1, 2, 3 instead of orthometapara. So if you review in your notes, I think we did a problem where we had an ethyl group and a halogen or something like that. At a one, something where we had 1,3 substitution. I could write another example really quickly up just to make sure. So that's chloroethyl benzene. Not ethyl chlorobenzene, because C comes before E, so we list the chlorine first. This is exactly the same issue that came up in the other problem I did do an example of, because we could, if we went the different ways around the circle, number the compound in two equivalent ways. Chlorine could be 1, the ethyl group 3, or the ethyl group 1 and chlorine be 3. And just like in that previous example, the tiebreaker is going to be alphabetization again, because chlorine is lower alphabetically, and because we do have a tie in how we number, we give chlorine the lowest number. So this would be 1 chloro, 3 ethyl benzene. Not in the most systematic version. So the most systematic way to do it is to use numbers. But it's still very common to see this called meta chloroethyl benzene. The reason that meta and ortho para are not necessarily the most systematic terms to use is what would you do in a case like this? Because chlorine and methyl are both ortho and meta. But you could also look at the two alkyl groups and call those ortho. So are you going to call this molecule ortho-ortho or ortho-meta? No. You'd use numbers to name this. You'd have to name this 2-2... Sorry, chloro. 1-chloro... 2-3 dimethyl benzene. Now, although I hesitate mentioning this because that will instantly make some of you worry, okay, wait, which way do we do this? Since we're not going to be doing a heck of a lot of naming of these compounds, I just want to throw out there that we do have names like toluene. Or we can look at this and say, isn't this a form of chlorinated xylene? Isn't this, as in some sense, chloro-ortho-xylene? Yes, but in the IUPAC system, there are certain of these common names that are allowed to be used for the compound itself, or when you're in general talking about substitution, just the way I did just then. I looked at that and says, that looks like a substituted xylene. But as far as naming a compound, to reduce the zillions of variations you might start getting in naming, by looking for and identifying these common names, we do everything much more systematically by making everything a substituted form of benzene. Did that help? Who asked? Did that help at all? Okay. Well, yes. One more question, and then around and around. Yes. Oh, that's one very, thank you for mentioning that. And I did remind the other class of this as well. But here, the hydrogenation of benzene is one of the ways of proving the stability of benzene. Did we ever get the correct hydrogenation numbers? So, is that what you're asking about? Okay. So, the numbers are negative 120, negative 232, and negative 208, like this. So that's not quite a full graph. Like this, the way I've drawn it, wouldn't be acceptable for full credit because I haven't labeled everything properly. But since you have a better written graph, you just need to substitute the numbers on there. The one that was wrong when we went over it was that one. I think that one I had quoted as negative 208, and it is negative 232. So there is still a small amount of stabilization due to conjugation. Remember that since that is essentially butadiene just trapped in a cyclic form, there is the small stability due to conjugation. But then further, the point is that benzene's the huge stabilizing. There's a huge stabilization that occurs there because you have that full cyclic conjugation. Now, you had another question. This was it? Yes? Oh, thank you.
Benzene.
There we go. So there were some questions over back here. Yeah. When you're doing a systematic, you don't what? Not when he abuses Meta. Well, I've done it. No. It's which way am I numbering? If I'm using numbers, I'll use numbers. If I'm doing it semi-systematically, I'll use letters. So last time I showed you an example, I named it systematically. If I named it with 1-3, then if I wanted to do it semi-systematically, I would have said meta. But you don't do both. So last time I did an example, I was doing it purely systematically. That's why there are no metas or orthos or anything like that. Other questions? All right, so we have time left, so let's do some new material. And in fact, let's go back, since we have the time to do this, let's review what endo and exo are in terms of Diels-Alder reactions. So, since I know that your brains are probably buried in aromaticity land, let me just remind you what's going on in the Diels-Alder reaction. Which, to do that, let me remind you of the previous discussion that we had, which was on paracyclic reactions. So paracyclic reactions, that was our first case where we really used this homolumo theory to point out and say which electrons are most energetic and where are the electrons most likely to go. In the paracyclic reaction case, that involved only one molecule, and we only looked at one molecular orbital. Because we looked at the molecular orbital that had the highest energy electrons, which are the ones that are most likely to start that paracyclic process. So if you reviewed your notes, we looked at two possibilities of whether we were at the ground state, which means we have heat as the way of starting the reaction, or whether we were at the excited state, and it was light being used to initiate the reaction. We took the molecular orbitals that corresponded to those highest energy electrons. We took the representations of those orbitals and put them on top of what the physical molecule looked like. We did that to show that those molecular orbitals can be used to predict why is it in the particular reaction that we did that at room temperature, the methyl groups on the end positions of the molecule that did twist, why those methyl groups went towards each other at the ground state, and why they appeared to go away from each other, but therefore rotating the same way, in the excited state. The Diels-Alder reaction is different in that you do have two molecules involved. And so it's this portion of the discussion that I truncated a little bit and want to start from there again to build to this endo-exo question. So as a reminder, the particular Diels-Alder reaction we were studying was one involving phthalic anhydride. Or no, maleic anhydride, sorry. Phthalic, that's the one in your lab. And I forgot, what was our target material? Was it cyclopentadiene we were reacting? When we were doing the molecular orbital description of it even? Okay, just making sure. So, the mechanism for this reaction is the following. That one of the double bonds starts this cascade event. Or one pushes one, which pushes the next, which reacts back with the first compound. So it's because of this cyclic set of arrows that this is called a paracyclic reaction. And there are two products that are generated. There we go. So notice in one product, the hydrogens are pointing down in a way that would be reminiscent of an axial position if we had a proper cyclohexane ring. And then the other form, the hydrogens appear to be pointed out, away from the ring, as if it were like equatorial. The group that gets substituted then, on the first one, is pointing more out from the ring, and the second one is pointing more into the ring. And so the first one is called the exoform, and the second one's called the endoform. Now, in terms of steric hindrance, which of these two forms do you think would be more favorable, the endo or the exo? Okay, we have endo and we have exo. You change your mind to exo? Why? Because if these were like equatorial and axial positions, remember that when you do have something in an equatorial position, that avoids steric hindrance. Where if you have it in the axial, you have this diaxial interaction. Now, even though this is not a proper cyclohexane ring, I could still point out that we have a hydrogen over on the other side here that could potentially have some steric interaction with the groups. So if you have it in the exo position, that's actually likely to have less steric hindrance than you would in the endo. But in the specific reaction, the endo is the major form. So there is an explanation for it, and my recollection is, unfortunately, that this is not included in your text. I forgot to verify right before class if it is or not, so I'll go back and check. But let me see if I can explain this carefully enough that we won't need your textbook. So what I had suggested as a model for this reaction is we look at the molecular orbital systems for the anhydride, and for the cyclopentadiene. Cyclopentadiene, its molecular orbitals look just like butadiene. So there's four molecular orbitals. I'm doing this very, very quickly because you already have a better picture of the orbitals somewhere else. So forgive the slight sloppiness this time around. That's because I just want to show which orbitals it is that might be involved in this case. Because when I showed you the reaction, I had told you that this occurs with heat. We need to know that because that's going to tell us we're in the ground state. The only reason I'm writing all four of these is so we can look and remind ourselves and say, oh yes, this is a system in which in the ground state, we have electrons just in two molecular orbitals. The second one up, that's the highest occupied molecular orbital. So for butadiene, that is the HOMO. And then the one right above with no electrons in it would be the LUMO. We could do the exact same thing with the anhydride. Because of time, I'm not going to write all six molecular orbitals down. I'll do like I did the other day and only write two of them. That, I realize, though, might confuse some of you. And why is he only writing two orbitals? Because, as what I've just written here shows you, we don't care about the bottom orbital. Those electrons are going to interact. We don't care about the top one, because that's not where the electrons are likely to go. So the other day, I only drew the two that mattered. I only drew the one that's the HOMO and the one that's the LUMO. So now let me do the HOMO and the LUMO for the anhydride. So in this case, since it's an even number of orbitals, we have half the orbitals bonding, half the orbitals antibonding. Since we have six orbitals total, that means there's three bonding and three antibonding. We want the third bonding orbital for the HOMO and the first antibonding orbital for the LUMO. Since we want the third bonding orbital, that would correspond to N equals 3, which means you have two nodes. So what happens is that either an electron goes from the HOMO of the six orbital system to the LUMO of the four, or the other way around. One goes from the HOMO of the four system to the LUMO of the six. It doesn't matter which way we allow this reaction to occur, not for our purposes, because the orbital argument we would make turns out to be exactly the same. So what I did was much like what we did with the paracyclic reactions. Take the pictures of the molecular orbitals, put them on top of the molecules themselves, and see what kind of interaction we have. Now, last time I only did one example, one way that I overlapped them. This time I'm going to do two, because we could have the five-membered ring relative to the anhydride oriented in two different ways. Or another way to say it is the anhydride itself is oriented two ways potentially relative to the cyclopentadiene. Now, just so we are looking at only one perspective, I'm going to declare that we'll use the HOMO of the anhydride and the LUMO of the cyclopentadiene. So for the cyclopentadiene, if we're using that LUMO, we will shade the orbitals in this way. Now let's draw the anhydride. This first way I've done this would effectively correspond to the exo reaction. Because as the bond connection gets made, that would just sort of push down on that ring, the oxygen pops up, that ends up like the exoform. Let's turn that compound upside down, though. This is the one that effectively would end up endo. I'm now going to put the orbital on top of it. Before I do, though, let me just look at this to see what kind of... Yes. So remember the comment I made the other day about how it's arbitrary whether I had this up, down, down, up shaded or down, up, up, down. So I was just verifying before I wrote in that anhydride homo that we are going to get the right answer, which we are. Because you can see that we do have the appropriate matching of phase between the two molecules. And so that overlap occurs. Notice that means you're starting to make sigma bonds because you're going to have head-to-head overlap here. That means that the pi bond that used to be there has to go away. That happens for both ends here, so you end up with two lone p orbitals, which end up forming the new double bond that you find in the product. Now we'll do the same thing on the other side here, and now I am going to pretend that I just turned the molecule 180 degrees around so I can keep my phases the same. And notice what happens. We have the same primary orbital overlap. But we have the neighboring orbitals.
Yes, I just wrote the wrong structure. Oh, got it.
You gave me a trick bottle. Maybe the bottle's just as tired this quarter as the rest of us are. Push it. Oh, I didn't want to break it, though. It just knows better than not to behave for you, that's all. There we go. Now that I have the right orbital, now we can see this secondary overlap. Since there's that much more interaction between the orbitals, then that now makes that a more favorable interaction, which is why I would prefer to be endo, even though that's not sterically the best result to occur. Now, of course, if you don't have this secondary overlap, it could be sterics that control the reaction. But this is just a classic example that's often shown that helps show why frontal orbital theory might be a reasonable explanation, because it is able to predict these otherwise strange results. So are there any questions about the two versions that I've just shown you here? All that's gone on is I've done two different geometries, molecules facing two different ways, to show why one way versus the other gives us a better electronic interaction. questions. Then get some sleep tonight. I'm sure you've had other instructors tell you that study after study after study shows, if you even get a little bit of sleep, that sleep is the time during which your brain processes and reorders and restores the information that you're trying to remember. So if you don't sleep, you can't remember. Not properly. Not long term. So even if you did survive tomorrow by pulling an all-nighter, you'd have to do it again and again and again to be ready for the final.